So, welcome. Those of you who have the misfortune of being here today, you'll have to hear me. You were warned, so it's your fault if you're here, you know, hearing me. Marco raised a good point in the chat that we typically don't know our full names. So I thought I would do a grand unveiling of another first name. You all know me by my first name, which is Nathaniel. I also have another first name. It's called Girish, which is my Indian name, if you have to say that. And it means Lord of the Mountains. Well, I'm not, but it's just, yeah. I wasn't named for that reason. It's just a name that my parents liked, and I like it too. But yes, so today you'll hear me speak about the book of Judges. And so I've titled it The Lessons in Looking Inward and Passing Onwards. And as we get into it, you'll understand what I mean by that. Looking inward in terms of introspection and passing it onwards. We're talking about oral traditions and how we relay that information of how good God is down generations. So that's the thing. So before I start, there's a few caveats and declarations. I have zero training in doctrine or anything like that. I have not done extensive doctrinal, you know, like self-study or things like that. It's mostly through Bible studies and things. So there will be no doctrine in my talk today. There's no real exposition on any biblical verses. I'm not trained for it, so I won't pretend I am. But I do believe that every Christian can speak on comprehension and application. What I mean by that is the three simple things that I read, I understand, I apply. Which basically goes to the concept of reading the Word of God, hearing the Word of God. You know, as you know, we read as not just with our lips, but we hear with the ears that God provides us with, the understanding, the comprehension, and then finally to be doers of the Word. So each person's life and experience is, and the burden that they have in their own hearts is an exemplar, as they call it. It shows an example of God's heart and mind. So each person has their own experience, their own context, and each person has a burden, a specific burden. Some may have it on maybe doctrine, some may have it on prayer, some may, you know, things like that. So my personal bent of mind, like I like history, and I like understanding context, like historical context. Doesn't mean that I do extensive studies on it, but that's just, you know, something I like. I gravitate towards it. And I'm especially interested in, you know, looking at character studies, either in the Bible or in real life or my own character, and to identify flavors in each person's character, which can be good, which can be bad, and can certainly be ugly. And often we have a tendency to make heroes of people, but I think the truth is that everybody has the capacity to be good because God allows it to be so. We are certainly bad, and we can show certain ugliness in our characters as well. And so it's important to identify those areas in our own lives and in the lives of our role models or people in our lives and, you know, place value to each aspect of that according to its worth. So if you see good in a person, you value it and you praise God for it. You see bad, you understand that we are all capable of it and you recognize it. Things like that. So that's what I'll be... So that's my burden. So if you you may have talked to me, you may have heard me ranting. So it comes from that place. So, you know, history and personalities. That's my interest. So this topic, don't worry, I'm not going to do a full-on slideshow. It's just to help me give you a spatial context. Like, so for me, history without geography is kind of incomplete. So when you're reading about history, you should also have a sense of what, where are we talking about. It can be about people, and obviously people reside somewhere on this earth. So even that is part of geography. So we'll be just, I'll be doing a synopsis of the very quick synopsis of the Book of Judges. You've all read the stories, but I think it's always helpful to sort of go through them again and reaffirm the lessons that ought to be learned from the examples of other people, and mainly that we worship God, because history, personalities, the history of peoples, it all shows God's work, how like his magnificent plan, his mercy, his goodness. And every book that we read, whether it be Numbers or Revelation or Gospels, I think his goodness is revealed in it. And we can then look at it through this this prism. And Judges is basically like a pre-monarchy history of how the land, the people of Israel, how they were right before they wanted monarchy and they got it. And I'll try to maybe convey a little context of that period of time. But before I start, I'll pray for myself and for you. So I'll just a quick prayer. Father, you are able to get your message across through anybody, anything. As you have said, the creation glorifies you. And yet, it is our responsibility as people to read your word, to understand it, and to comprehend your heart and your mind. Today, as I speak, Father, help me. As you helped Balaam's donkey, help me to be at least be as clear as that donkey, and help the people who hear, the congregation, to look beyond the imperfections of the messenger and to focus on the message itself. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So, I'm going to... Right. So this is Judges. Don't worry. Very basically, like, you could read history as a study of the people group. You can study it as a study of personalities. You could look at patterns in history, and you can look at history as a purpose. So I think even in the secular study of history, these are kind of broad categories of how you approach history. So you could, for example, in Finland, you could study it as a history of the Finnish people, or you could study it as a history of the personalities, maybe like Mannerheim or somebody like that, and how they have affected the Finnish nation. You could even study it through purpose, which is apparently a bit newer, but so what was the purpose of the events that happened in a particular place and time? And patterns definitely. So I think Judges can be approached through all four streams. You can look at it as a history of the people of Israel. You can look at it as a study of personalities of the 13, 14 judges that we have in the Book of Judges. You can look at it as certainly as a study of patterns, like how people, they forget, they sin, they get persecuted, they cry out, and God saves. So these are patterns that happen about seven times recorded in the Book of Judges. And also, like, in the end, the purpose. There's a reason this book is in the Bible. There's a reason God made sure this record was passed down to us, and that we read it, and what is that purpose? So, so this is just to, I will come back to this, but just to give you a timeline. So this is like the exact dates, I haven't been able to narrow down. Some people say 1350 onwards. This is BC, so before Christ. Some say it's about 1200 BCE onwards. But almost everybody agrees that it the period of Judges ends somewhere between after Saul's coronation as king and before David's capture of Jerusalem. Because there are very clear evidence of that. So it's about a 40-year period where, so 1040 BC to 1000 BC. So the book was written by Samuel, most likely. It's not self-attested, but people, I think that's the general consensus. It was written somewhere between 1043 BC and 1000 BC. And the other thing is, like, who was the audience? So I think, so it is important to know then when it was it written, because obviously it was written to address a certain audience. And I think this was the audience that was new to the monarchy. This is my interpretation. So they were new to the monarchy, so they had just been united for the first time under a single leader, like formalized leadership. And I think Samuel also intend, if he is the one who wrote it, he intended it, this book, as a perhaps a cautionary tale of what went wrong when, as it says in the book, that in those days there were no kings and everybody did what was right in their own eyes. So I think that had a sense of conveying caution to the people of Israel once that under the monarchy, that I think monarchy is not the solution, you still need to be careful. So I think that's my interpretation of why it was written, like who was the audience and for what purpose was it written, perhaps. And it goes somewhere between 1350 to 1200 BC, like the starting period of where the first judge is functioning, to about somewhere between here, where between Saul's and David's capture of Jerusalem. So you could think that starts somewhere here, ends somewhere here. And so I want to give you a sense of the context. Like, what was the world like back then? I certainly had a very detached sense of what was the surrounding, what was happening around Israel, the people of Israel, when they moved into Canaan and were occupying and conquering this land. We tend to almost separate biblical history from, you know, general history. It's almost as if, like, we don't read history east of the Bible. You only know as far east as the Bible goes, and then everything else is, well, it's secular, so it doesn't matter. But, I mean, just to give you an example, like, so this is actually not even complete. I couldn't find a really good map. So there's also the Americas at the moment. So they've already had, like, for example, Egypt already was going through the third golden period. So people were established. China had the Shang civilization. I think it's like probably the first major formal civilization. I think there was one before that, like Zhao or something. They were after this, I think. So anyway, like proper civilization. So you can see that, I don't know how much you would agree with this categorization, but it's more just as a helpful thing. Like, you know, the hunter-gatherers, well, I don't know. Then they have like farmers, peoples, and then they identify civilization as a higher level of organization. So you have the Egyptians, obviously, like the Middle East, the current day Middle East was hotbed for civilizations. You have Egypt and Africa, you have the Indus Valley civilization in South Asia, Shang civilization in China, you have the Olmec civilization in Central America. So people by this time are already very well organized. There's also trade happening. So it's not as if they were all living in their own tiny forest, didn't know what was happening elsewhere. And the reason I'm doing this is that to show that Israel was a very minor group of people. They had just come out of the Exodus from Egypt. They were not a significant force, cultural force, so to say. They entered into a land that was going through upheavals. It was the frontier zone, a highly prized frontier zone between the Egyptian Empire and the Hittite Empire. And so this is around 1400 BC. So this is about 100 years before they actually were showed up in the land of Canaan. So there was, in that area, you had the Egyptian Empire, the Assyrian Empire there, the Kassite Empire, the Mitanni, the Hittites, and these were, there were really a lot of power struggles going on. And it all the power struggle was basically centered around Israel. So Israel, or the land of Canaan, was the frontier zone where battles were fought, frontiers went up and down, things like that. And it's in this environment that God brought his people to conquer the local peoples. So what was the region like? So I've already said that there are these large empires, powerful empires with equipment and military infrastructure that far exceeded Israel's. There were powerful kingdoms. So the Amorites, the Moabites, so the kingdom of Moab, Moab, as they say, but Moab, Edom, Ammon, Amalek, you know, all these, they were powerful kingdoms. They were not empires, and they were certainly under the sway of the Egyptians or the Hittites or the Assyrians. So they were kind of like vassals, but they had power of their own. And then there were very prosperous city-states, like especially Phoenician city-states like Tyre and Sidon, which are on the coast, the Mediterranean coast of the Levant. And right in about here. So basically very early into the actual conquest of the land, there was a major global, I would say, maybe like regional collapse of certain civilizations there because of the migration of something people have termed it as sea peoples. They don't know where they came from, possibly from the Black Sea, Caspian Sea area. And there was a lot of upheaval. So Egypt was kind of on the back foot. Assyria was also fighting it out with the Hittite Empire. So this was like a disruption that was happening in this area. So a lot of people migrating in, out, and getting displaced. So like a lot of Philistines and Phoenicians who were displaced by the sea peoples, then they were making their way into the land of Canaan. So, yeah, all this to say that when Israel entered the land, it entered a land that was well-established, was very well-developed, rich, and rich to the point that probably in terms of prosperity and infrastructure superior to the people of Israel. And there were disruptive things happening. So it was a period of turmoil as well. And I think this is what makes their occupation, whatever little they actually managed to occupy, they were supposed to occupy more, but we'll read that they didn't. So the fact that they actually occupied whatever they did is a miracle, and it's a showing of God's power, the fact that they could displace nations that were well-established and superior in infrastructure. So this is that context. So again, 1400 BCE, so about maybe 100 years, 150 years before, or maybe just during Exodus, or yeah, few decades before the Exodus. So this was what was happening. The Kassite Babylonians, the Mitanni, the Assyrians kind of come over here soon, like Assur. The Hatti, which is basically the Hittite region, the Anatolian Hittites, and then Egypt. And there was like a massive power struggle between these four regions. by 1274 BC, possibly around when Joshua died or when judges were ruling. So it was basically the Egyptians versus the Hittites. And this is, I think, at this year they had a major battle in Kadesh. I guess it would be current-day Syria. And it was just interesting that the first non-Jewish mention of the Jewish people, or of the people of Israel, was by the pharaoh, Meremta, or Merneptah. We don't know what the correct pronunciation is, but Meremta Stele. Stele is basically this big, it's the social media post of the old world. So, look what I did. This is, you know, this kind of humble bragging that I came here, I destroyed these people, you know, that kind of a thing. So, after 1270, I think it's probably about 60 years after this time, Pharaoh Meremta took over the 18th dynasty of the Egyptians. They had a major battle. So he had a major incursion into the Assyrian and Hittite lands. And it mentions somewhere here in the bottom that Israel is no more. Wait, let me get it right. Israel is wasted. Its seed is no more. So that is the first instance where Israel is actually mentioned in a secular source. if somebody doubts the validity or historicity, yeah, that's the word. So then we at least have even secular sources saying that. Of course, Israel was not wasted, and its seed certainly prospered. Some people argue that its seed is no more. The Pharaoh was referring to that he probably plundered the fields and destroyed the grain. But more likely that he meant to say that, you know, those people are gone. And you could understand why, because some people argue that it's his father who was the unnamed Pharaoh in Exodus who wouldn't let the Jews go. So perhaps it was also a matter of pride to say that, you know, these people who caused so much damage to, you know, his father's reign, I have wasted them, whether it be true or not. So propaganda is very old in the world. He who writes it, they win it. But of course, we can thank God that we have the Bible, and therefore his propaganda doesn't work. So that's the... let me see if I have some more. Okay. So... So the book is typically divided into three parts. We have like the first two chapters. So from verses, like the first verse onwards till chapter 3, verse 6, it starts as a prologue. It gives a background of how Joshua, he dies, he dies, and then Caleb basically takes it on for Judah, and we'll come back to this. So it starts with saying that, they decide, or they ask God who should go into the land first. Because now Joshua has died. They've, I think, only really captured Jericho. So they have a beachhead into the land that they're supposed to conquer and occupy. And Joshua dies. I think he's 110 years old. And they ask God, who starts? And God says, Judah. So Judah and Simeon, since they're allocated kind of... I haven't been able to find like a very clear line. There were no clear lines. God basically told them, this region, this city, you know, that's how they got it, between this river and that river. So Judah and Simeon together, they start and they go through Jebus, or like Jerusalem. They go towards Hebron. I think there's a city over there. I forget the name now. So probably kind of a very well guarded city. Let me just get it right. Yeah, so the city of Debir, somewhere over here. Apparently, I suppose it was well guarded. So Caleb basically offers the hand of his daughter, Aksa, to whoever occupies or defeats that city and conquers it. So Caleb's younger brother, Othniel, Othniel ben Kenaz, son of Kenaz, he conquers it and he gets Aksa. And it's kind of an interesting short story over there, how then Aksa meets her father and gets a promise for some springs of water. So this is basically the Negev, kind of a wilderness desert area, somewhere over here. So her inheritance through her marriage to Othniel is in an arid area. So she actually approaches her father, Caleb, and gets him to kind of promise her, them, some springs of water as well. So, you know, pragmatic woman. So I don't know why the story is there, but I think it's interesting that she took it upon herself to execute wisdom and get a little more promises out of her father. So then the prologue, so the introduction till chapter 3, verse 6, then goes into how, okay, Judah then defeats the Philistines in Ashkelon, Ekron, and Gaza. So these are sort of cities over here. I think like Ekron is somewhere here, and then those things. So these are plains now. So they start the occupation through the central highlands. So you can see the topological relief over here. So these are actually mountain territories or hill territories. So they start from the hills, and then the Judah and Simeon, they make way to the Philistines over here. So Ashkelon, Ekron, and Gaza over here. And they actually defeat the people in the plains. So these areas are basically the plains area. They defeat it, but then immediately it says that they were not able to displace them. They were sanctioned to displace the people, to drive out the people. They were not to mingle and kind of hold alliances within their regions with the local peoples, but they were not successful. And then it goes on to list that all of the tribes, none of them actually managed to occupy what was given to them, allotted to them. Some failed more spectacularly, like the tribe of Dan. So they basically got this area, which was basically plains. And Benjamin, maybe they were a bit more successful. Ephraim, a bit more. But then they still didn't capture the valleys. So the theme here is the tribes of Israel, they managed to capture some of the land. And typically, these are the hill areas. And they are unable to, unwilling to, or just don't have enough faith to conquer the valleys. And typically, you will see that all over the world, it's the valleys and the plains that are more established. They're more prosperous. You have larger cities in the valleys. And yet, and that's why perhaps like they were not able to, because as I said, they entered a land that was, you know, that had seen war, they were well established, and so it was difficult. So they had to have faith, and they had to have trust in God, as Joshua's stories and Caleb's stories, that they show that it is not about your military experience or superiority, it's about faith in God. And I think this is this shows an evidence of the lack of faith that the people of Israel had as they had to get down to the business of actually conquering the land. Now that Joshua was gone, they didn't have a kind of a rallying leader of that caliber. Perhaps they started settling into cities and started relaxing. You know, happens. It's so typically when you look at, okay, what were the 12 tribes once they went into the land of Canaan? This is what you see. Okay, you know, Judah was here, Simeon was here, Reuben, Gad, Manasseh, and all that. But actually, perhaps this is more realistic. Yes, it was allotted to them, but what they actually occupied and had influence over was perhaps this, or maybe even less than this. So you can see that the shaded area is where they really had some influence, and you can see that it's basically all the mountain territories. So the land of Israel has two major valleys that cuts across. I don't know which one is, now I don't forget, like, I think this is the Valley of Jezreel, right? So there's that Megiddo, the city of, like, supposed to be Armageddon. So these are the two valleys, and this is where they are not able to capture that land. So they have these small pockets over here, then Zebulun, Issachar, Naphtali, and Asher, they're basically limited to that pocket. And also here, then you have Jebus, or Jerusalem later. It's a pocket by itself in the mountains. So we have a sense that we think from our current national boundaries or things like that. You enter a land, you set a border post, you have a fence or whatever. But it wasn't like that. They would conquer, the Israeli tribes, they would conquer a city. Often they would have to retreat then. So it's a conquered people, it's a conquered city, yes, but they haven't been able to displace the people. So they haven't actually occupied it. They haven't, completely sort of taken it over. And they go basically from town to town or city to city or stronghold to stronghold. It doesn't necessarily mean that they control every part of it or they control the valleys. They may control the hilltops. So it's a very fractured occupation. It's not like they have a frontier and everything behind the frontier, they have absolute control and sovereignty, and beyond it is where the fighting is happening. And this is what will come back to haunt them, because now they have an influence, they have pockets of Gentiles, they have pockets of Gentile enemies, and yeah, so then for the next 200 years, they'll have to deal with this. So in the prologue, which is the introduction, like the first two chapters, the overarching theme is the failure to conquer, the failure to complete the conquest after Joshua. There can be many reasons. In fact, God himself, if I can get the Bible, God himself gives certain reasons, not for the failure to conquer, but reasons for the conquest to happen in a very staggered and staged manner. So if we turn to Judges chapter 3, verse 4. So there he says, they were for the testing. So they being the nations that were still around, that hadn't been displaced. So they were for the testing of Israel to know whether Israel would obey the commandments of the Lord, which he commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. And then another reason is verse 2 in the same chapter, chapter 3, verse 2. It was only in order that the generations of the people of Israel might know war, to teach war to those who had not known it before. So now, I mean, this is also bring to the context that there was a couple of generations that grew up, perhaps like right after or during Joshua's entry into the land of Canaan. And they hadn't seen war, perhaps, like a generation or two, like proper war. And then there's another reason in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 22. chapter 7. So the Lord your God will clear away these nations before you little by little. You may not make an end of them at once, lest the wild beasts grow too numerous for you. So there's also kind of a pragmatic reason for having a smoother natural transition for the nature itself. So, but note here, God doesn't say that you let them, you know, that you kind of don't complete the conquest within the area that you start. It just means that he's not going to give you the entire land of Canaan in one battle, like one big battle. He could have done that. I mean, everybody, how many times have the Canaanites actually banded together and then they fight Israel? It could have happened. But these are the reasons. So pragmatic reasons, because God knows our hearts, we are human. So he left, like he said that, okay, there will be a stage-by-stage conquest of the land, first to know, so that people know war. So, I mean, this is a good indication that, you know, war by itself is not a vice that one should, like, you know, absolutely, oh, I'm, like, you know, I should run away from war. War is bad. I think it's, everything depends on the reason, the justification, and who sanctifies that war, like who sanctions it. So here, God wanted the people to be disciplined. War brings discipline. Testing times bring discipline. So, and he wanted these nations to be a test of Israel's faithfulness and their and their hope in God. And of course, then there was the whole thing that, okay, if you conquer the entire land, there were a lot of people in Israel, but there weren't that many to absolutely kind of occupy the land and to make it productive. We bought a cottage 3 years back, and now that we bought this house, it is surprising how one season, like one finished summer season of neglect, can overgrow a patch of productive area. Trees come up, you have like these bushes. We have tools now, and it's still hard. You know, power tools. And you can imagine now with Israel kind of busy fighting, they won't have the capacity, the human resource to actually be able to produce also in that land. So it actually makes a lot of sense that God decided, let's do it stage by stage. But what I think the problem was, the people of Israel then fell into two main temptations. Again, my interpretation, obviously the temptation was they sinned against God. That's not the temptation. That was the sin. But what was the temptation that led them to the sin? Number one, I would say covetousness. They entered a land that was prosperous. They were highly skilled people, perhaps more skilled than the Jews themselves. There's a case to be made for like the Kenites, who are, I think, Moses' father-in-law's people. They are basically, I think, they used to occupy this land, who were very friendly to the Jews. When the Jews came in during the Exodus, they were the ones who welcomed Moses and his people and all that. They were highly skilled metallurgists, I think. But they were sort of Bedouin nomad people who were kind of meant to stay in tents. But they followed the Jewish people all around. And there was a lot the Jews learned from them. And it can be said the same about all the Amalekites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, and things like that. They were skilled people. They were evil, yes, but they were also skilled. And I think it is very seductive to assimilate into a society that has prosperity on offer, like worldly prosperity. And once they started occupying one city after the other, they started getting settled, and then they started looking around, skill sets, started making compromises. Why waste a workforce? You know, that's the other temptation. You have land, and the prologue also says that, you know, they didn't drive them out, but their hand was heavy on these Gentile, Canaanites. And so they forced them into labor. So that is a very pragmatic reason. You know, you have people, you can force them to work your fields and things like that. Why lose labor? Labor force is very expensive, even today. But I think that that is where they sinned. It's okay to be pragmatic as long as it doesn't go against God's explicit command to drive out the people. And I think the seduction of assimilation, as I call it, was so great that they sinned and did not occupy. And that seduction also lowered their faith in God, perhaps. They didn't pray to God as much when they were wanting to conquer. So, yeah, all very fallen human reasons for these things to happen. And in all this, one aspect that stood out for me was in this prologue that, the consequences of our compromises, the compromise that we do today as a family, as a people, as a church, whatever, as a group of people, it affects the future generations. Even though our sins are, yes, our sins, no, they won't be visited upon the heads of our children, but that doesn't mean the effect and the consequences will not have to be suffered by them. And that is a major takeaway from this, that that generation chose to compromise. And for the next 200-300 years, they really had a hard time. They had cycles. It doesn't mean that every year of those 200 years was bad, but they had to go through cycles of desperation and crying out and, remorse. Of course, the positive, well, not the positive, but something that is significant to also understand is that God had three good reasons to not give the land of Canaan to the Israelites too easily. He says there will be a test to you. You will know war. So, this is the positive side of having testing times or testing people who test you or circumstances that test you. It is fire that cleanses us. We need it. We are human. Gratitude is not a personality trait that is, prevalent among humans. And even if somebody does have the gift of being grateful for a longer period of time, we are still forgetful. And that's the thing. So when tests come, you immediately, people of God, the elect, they turn to God. And that keeps you on the straight and narrow. And so I'm going to, this was how it starts in the first two chapters of Judges. And the last three, four chapters, so chapters 17 onwards, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, so five chapters, it basically describes the prevailing environment. So the Judges are in three parts. First is an introduction of the, what happened after Joshua died. Okay, they started the conquering process. They didn't manage to do it. And, why they did not manage to do it. Then the middle part is all about the judges who ruled, who judged the people of Israel. And then the end part actually gives you the context, what was the sin that people were getting into. So it gives two very good examples of how deep and perverse the sins were. It gives you a sense of how bad the situation was. And the sins were, let's say in this case, committed by the tribes of Dan and to some extent Ephraim. But mostly the tribe of Dan, the sin was idolatry, where they appropriate the idol of an Ephraimite, and they entice a disgraced Levite priest to say that, come be our tribe's priest. And so they take an idol, they take the a dishonest priest, and then they set up their own worship. They give up on the land that was allotted to them, which is over here, and then they migrate all the way between Naphtali and Manasseh over there, which is another rebellion against God. So instead of praying to God that, hey, we are finding this difficult, they decide to just move. And so that was a sin of idolatry, exemplified by the tribe of Dan. And then there was the sin of immorality, exemplified by what the Gibeonites, like Gibeon over here, the tribe of Benjamin did. So very quickly, tribe of Dan, idolatry. There's a guy of the tribe of Ephraim who lived in the hills, hill territory. Basically, Ephraim is pretty much entirely hill territory, who stole 1,100 pieces of silver. And you can imagine, I don't know if I'm right in this, but it's a significant amount of money, and I'll tell you why. So he stole 1,100 pieces of silver from his mother, and then he decides to confess. And again, cautionary tales to mothers around. So the mother is such a, like a useless disciplinarian, I guess. She's so happy that he confessed that she actually gives him, okay, you know, you keep 200 pieces of silver. I'll make you this idol of some local gods. You know, you can add it to your collection. So that guy was already idolatrous. He was apparently collecting idols, local idols. He stole this money. He confessed. Mother gets impressed by his confession, gives him 200 pieces of silver out of the 1,100, and tells him, okay, you know, here's another new idol. You can be the priest for this god. And if you remember, I think by Jewish law, that kid, well, he confessed, so I don't know what the law would say, but technically anybody who commits idolatry is to be stoned to death. So instead of taking it seriously, she actually rewards him. So you can see that the family situation itself was a gone case. Anyway, so then there's a Levite, I think, who was probably running away from some scandal from the land of Benjamin. He lands up at their house. He sees this list or like a line of idols. He says, oh, hey, you have pretty impressive collection. And so I think Micah is the name of the Ephraimite who has these idols. He says, how about you become my priest? So, and he pays him 10 silver coins per year plus lodging and board. So you can imagine that if 10 is the salary for a year, he stole 1,100. That's a lot of money if that makes sense. So this Levite, disgraced Levite, joins in into the sin of idolatry. And then the tribe of Dan, they are migrating, so they are exploring the land that they want to occupy. So then they are going through this guy's house, Micah's house. They look at this, they look at the list of idols, they look at a Levite, and they find this very interesting. Here they have a bunch of religious motives. They have that house has established a priesthood. They have a ready-made religion. So they tell this Levite, they're stealing this idols. The Levite says, hey, what are you doing? They say, do you want to be a priest to this guy? Do you want to be a chaplain? Or do you want to be a priest to the entire tribe? The Levite absolutely loves the idea, and he joins them to their migration up north. The tribe of Dan effectively steals a little from Naphtali and occupies Laish. Another interesting story over there. So they named it Dan, but it was called Laish. And apparently it was a people that were very prosperous. They had everything. They had want of nothing. And they were very unsuspecting people. So basically Dan and goes and occupies the people that that were not expecting it. So it was a takeover that was probably not sanctioned by God. So that was a sin of idolatry. And I think this doesn't mean that it's only the tribe of Dan that was doing it. I think this was just the worst case that was happening. And it was like probably happening all over the tribes of Israel during different periods of time and different people and the different clans. And then the sin of immorality. There was a story of a Levite who has a concubine. And in a very, in a story that is reminiscent of Lot's story in Sodom. So they're sojourning and they reach Gibeon. And I think his wife or concubine, she says that, hey, should we go to this city, which was a Gentile city? So the guy says, no, 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 we are not going to stay with the Gentiles. We'll stay with our people. So then they go to Gibeon, a bit further up. They stay in the marketplace for a long time, you know, similarity to the Lot story, where the angels of God are loitering in the marketplace, but nobody's inviting them. Same thing happens to them. Finally, an old guy comes and says, you know, hey, I'll house you, don't stay here. So that itself shows you that staying in the marketplace was not a good idea in that place, which means how sinful was that city already. So he takes him to the house. The people find out that this man and his wife are traveling. They come, knock on this man's door in Gibeon and say that, you know, this man came, we want to basically violate him. Again, the sin of homosexuality, similar to what, you know, the story of Lot in Sodom. And again, the same kind of a sin, but even worse now, because the host basically says, hey, I have a daughter, you can have her, or you can have his wife. So he basically offers the guy, like, you know, his guest's wife. Absolutely deplorable kind of a behavior. And the Levite, the guest, also doesn't protest. So basically, they just drag her out. They throw her out of the door. They have their way with her. And the poor thing, she manages to come to the back to the threshold of the house, but she dies in the morning. And this guy, without any remorse, this Levite, weak, weak man, apparently he slept also, like, so that's how weak he was, like sinful, wakes up in the morning, opens the door, tells her, wake up, let's go, not even realizing that she's dead. He sees then she's dead, puts her on the donkey, and I think takes her home, cuts her up into 12 pieces, parcels it to all the 12 tribes. And this is the first instance where the tribes then unite for a single purpose of, you know, for a sense of justice. But it's actually a civil war. Not the 12, but yeah, you know, except Benjamin. So the tribe of Benjamin, they are so incensed that the other tribes are meddling in their affairs that they decide to fight. So they decide to defend the indefensible. And basically, there's a massive civil war. I think it's about like 400,000 the people of Israel, like all the other tribes of Israel, they gathered for war against Benjamin. It's actually not an easy battle. The tribe of Benjamin wins at least twice or thrice. And in the end, God tells them, tomorrow morning I will have them into your hand. And the battle is so vicious that there are only 600 men of Benjamin left out of some 20,000 odd men. And the other 11 tribes, they suddenly realize what has happened, that they've almost wiped off an entire tribe from among themselves. So then there's a story of they try to find wives for these for this tribe from the Gentiles first. Oh, no, they find it from a city that did not join the war effort. So apparently that's a capital punishment. If you don't join an Israeli joint effort. So they actually go kill all the men in that city that refuse to join in this kind of a righteous battle. And then they basically take those women and give them, or like the unmarried ones, they give them to the 600 remaining men of Benjamin. And and then there is a whole story of how there were still only 400 women, so there are still 200 single men left. And then they kind of said that, okay, you can go and capture, we'll just look the other way. You can go and capture some women from nearby tribes. Anyway, so the point here is the extreme immorality of that situation, where a tribe even defends that city. You would think that they would have the memory of Lot, Abraham's nephew, like how the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was so deplorable to God, and yet they did the same thing in the tribe of Benjamin. And yeah, so that's the thing. What I did was study Judges from the context of the people, like the tribes, the people groups, the peoples that were already there in Canaan. But now we can get into very quickly into the personalities in Judges, of course. So apparently, it's kind of misleading to call these people, these 13 people, judges, because in Hebrew, the word judge is only used as a verb for them. So Othniel judged, Samson judged, but they were never called judges as a noun. So that word was, as a noun, was only used for God. Which is, it is significant. So basically, God is the judge. All these judges that we call them, they are basically instruments or executors of God's judgment. So they're not judges in the typical capacity of law or things like that. They're different kind of people. They were warriors. They were female administrators, things like that. So if you just run through... So we have about 13 of them mentioned, if you count Deborah and Barak as one, 14 if you count them as two. And one of them, Abimelech, is technically not a judge, but he kind of was the ruler during that civil war period. So, okay. And also, as this shows... All the 13 judges, they did not rule consecutively. So it is not like one after the other after the other. A lot of the judges were ruling concurrently in different parts of the country. So, for example, maybe Gideon was in the north, Othniel was in the south, things like that. So, and yet there were some judges who took over from the other one. So like, after Othniel, there was Ehud, so something like that. So we'll be going through them very quickly, just in the order of appearance. So this is that. Yeah, this one. So you can see that where the judges were based. So Othniel was in the south, in the land of Judah, Ibzan, Samson, Ehud, Deborah, and all that. So... So quickly, in order of appearance in the Bible, that would be the credits. So Othniel, as I said, Othniel ben Kenaz, the younger brother of Caleb, one of the two spies who was blessed by God and was promised Hebron for his courage, when the spies go out into the land of Canaan. So his younger brother, probably very proud parents, they have... The two stalwarts of the conquest. So Othniel, very accomplished soldier. Clearly, he wins over a very difficult to win city, Debir. And then he fought in the north against... So his main enemy was Kushan Rishnathaim. So basically, I think Kushan is kind of like people group. Rishnathaim is, I think, like twice evil or something. So I think it's kind of a moniker for that king. So Aram Naharain is basically Mesopotamia. Like Naharain is between two rivers. So northwest Mesopotamia, so about over there, kind of the... and there's that, so not much information apart from that. Then after Othniel was Ehud, his main enemy was during his time, the enemy was Moab. Moab is basically over here. He was a lefty, apparently he's from a tribe of Benjamin, and tribe of Benjamin was famous for having left-handed warriors, which is, I think, kind of a interesting thing, because I think Benjamin means son of my right hand, but they're all lefty warriors. And most people will tell you that left-handed warriors had a certain advantage when most people are right-handed, because the way you swing your sword and things like that gives you a certain advantage. And so Moab was, I think, heavy on the on Israel for 18 long years. The people cry out, so God raises Ehud, who is a lefty, who basically hides a dagger, 18-inch dagger, which is like a, 30 centimeters something, dagger inside his right thigh. Possibly because when people are frisked, when they enter the king's quarters, you frisk, so right hand, left leg. Are you hiding something? Everybody assumes you're right-hander. But he had it on the opposite side. So he goes into the presence of this king. He says, I have a secret message from God. So the king gets eager and says, okay, everybody out. Ehud approaches the king, who is supposed to be so fat that when Ehud stabs him, and imagine 18 inches is at least, 30 centimeters. It's about this big. It goes in, the entire blade goes in, and the hilt. So the handle of it. So to the point that the fat closes around the handle, that he can't bring it out. So he just leaves the knife in, closes the door behind him, and in the confusion, where the servants are kind of not sure what's happening, maybe he's resting or something like that, Ehud escapes and then goes into the territory of Ephraim, assembles the tribes of Israel. They slaughter about 10,000 people of Moab. And there's peace for 80 years. That is significant. 18 long years is a lot of time to be suffering under somebody. That's basically a generation. But 80 years is even more, is quite impressive as well. But that doesn't mean... So if you go here, so this is Ehud. Eglon, King Eglon of Moab is killed here. So there's 80 long years of peace for Israel. So some stability there. So he dies. Then there's a very short introduction for Shamgar. Most likely that he killed 600 Philistines. Maybe I'll just keep this here. Yeah, so Shamgar kills 600 Philistines. It's most likely that Shamgar, Ben Anat, so he's not an Israelite. It's possible that he was an Israelite, sort of a non-Israelite ruler over Israel, or maybe a collaborator or something, we don't know. Ben Anat. Anat is a Canaanite god. Apparently in archaeology they have found tokens and items with the title Ben Anat. So it could be a title for a warrior, like son of a warrior god or something. Shamgar, then Deborah, and the commander Barak. So now the enemy is Canaan, King Jabin, or Yabin. And Sisera is the commander of this king, who had 900 chariots. And Barak is basically commissioned by Deborah to fight these men. And obviously Barak is probably already a military man, but he shows great weakness in asking Deborah to join the battle, exposing her to danger and things like that. So for his kind of hesitation and kind of a weakness, the prize of him having, so the glory of him defeating Sisera is taken away from him, or killing Sisera. It's actually given to a woman as a kind of a lesson to him. So anyway, so they basically ambush Sisera, the commander of King Yabin, in the river Kishon, which is apparently a marshy area. So they have 900 chariots. And just imagine, now Israel is not very adept at armor and, you know, metalworking, that they have the latest and gadgets for warfare. Chariots are basically tanks those days. So Barak musters 10,000 people, but Sisera has 900 chariots. So that is one chariot for almost every 10 soldiers, which is an overwhelming number of chariots. And he had 900 chariots plus soldiers. But it was a complete rout, praise God, entirely because of God's thing and God's wisdom to Deborah, where she lays a trap for the chariots, iron chariots. So Sisera then has to abandon his chariot, which is stuck in the mud, possibly, and he runs. He finds his way to a Kenite camp. And again, I mentioned Kenites because they are the people of Moses' father-in-law, very friendly towards the tribes of Israel. But these, so Kenite and her husband, so the woman is names is Yael, and her husband Heber, the Kenite, they have kind of a peace with the Canaanites, so with King Jabin. So I think Sisera enters her tent as a refuge because she invites him, and as he's exhausted, he sleeps, he takes a tent peg and puts it through his head. And so this is her own initiative, which is commendable, and that's why I think she finds mention as, you know, a righteous thing to do. So that's how then peace is maintained. Canaan is, I think, almost forever then defeated, if I'm not wrong. Anyway, and then there is Gideon. This is a famous story. So now the enemy is Midian. The Midianites, basically, they come from this area, sort of the northwest of Arabia. Harsh enemies, and Midians basically then collaborate with, the Midians collaborate with Amalek people and subjugate the people of Israel. They're heavy on them. And this, now the pre-incarnate Jesus basically comes and personally anoints Gideon as he's working in his father's house. And Gideon is another example of men who show weakness, which is absolutely any one of us can be doing that. But this is an example of that. Like, he is a strong man, and he's being personally invited by the angel of God, which is the pre-incarnate Jesus. In a story similar to Abraham's, when, before Lot's things happen, so pre-incarnate Jesus visits Abraham as Abraham is sitting under the tree. Abraham runs in, makes a feast as a sign of hospitality. Gideon does the same. And God gives him a sign by actually consuming that feast, not as food, but as a sacrifice. So there is a fire on the stone. He tells him to pour the broth on the meal. There's a fire, and the fire goes up to heavens, and Gideon realizes that, yes, this is God. And then it's interesting that Gideon then starts, because there's idolatry happening by this time already. So Gideon starts first removing the sin in his immediate vicinity. He first goes to there are certain altars in his father's land. He breaks them down, but he does it, perhaps it says, because he was more afraid, like too afraid of the villagers, what they would say. So he does it in the night. Maybe pragmatic, maybe fear. He shows in the few, like in later story, that he is fearful. So perhaps it was more about fear. So he does it in the night. People come in the morning. His father actually defends him. It's like, who are you to do it? Like, let Baal defend himself. So that's why I think Gideon's other name is called Yerubbaal, a person who contends with Baal or something like that. So, and then the moment of, so Gideon gathers troops. Gideon asks for two signs. Again, a sign of kind of hesitation and fearful hesitation. Can we really do this kind of a thing? And again, we have to understand that there is every reason I might also do the same thing. You all might do the same thing. Because tomorrow, if somebody says, you know, go and fight against, I don't know, well, Russia or, I don't know, the U.S. Army or something like that, they are so advanced, it is but natural to have that doubt. Can we even do this? And I think Gideon also had that problem. And yet, it is not justified because God is with you. God has shown you a sign, a supernatural sign already. And yeah, so Gideon asked for two more signs. He asked for one sign with the fleece, made, you know, wet fleece in the morning with the surrounding area dry. I'll take it as a sign. God does it. He says, okay, one more time. Don't be angry. One more time. Fleece dry, but the surrounding area wet. God indulges him. Okay, again, it happens. Then he's assured. Then he musters about 30,000 people. And then as he is like encamped, and probably should be like opposite to the army of the Midianites, he's again fearful. And I think here God preempts that. So God says, if you are fearful, go with your servant as a covert spy and see what the soldiers are saying. I like this because God already knows our heart. Gideon has already shown that he's been afraid three times. So instead of God reprimanding him, he understands the weakness. It's not justified, but it's understandable. I think there's two different emotions over there. And God is kind and is merciful to give Gideon so many signs, like three signs after the first, like, you know, the sacrifice, the supernatural sacrifice. That, and then Gideon's heart is kind of strong. He fights. And then there's a whole case of how 32,000 people are pared down to only 300 people. So we all know that story. And yet it ends with a kind of a bad note. The people of Israel say, why don't you be our king? Gideon, I think, rightfully says, no, I will not be your judge. God will be your judge. But he says, I won't be your judge, but okay, give me one earring from everybody's thing. So he gets about 17 or 20 kilos of gold because everybody gives one earring from their plunder. With that gold, he makes a breastplate, an ephod. I think it's basically a breastplate. It can be more elaborate, but I don't know. And that becomes a sign, like it becomes a start of idolatry for not Gideon, but his household or the people around him. So I'm not sure whether he should have done it, like, you know, get a memento. Like, you know, he wanted something to commemorate God's hand in victory through his hand, like through Gideon's hand. But anyway, it becomes a snare to the people of Gideon and to the people around him. And he had one major problem. He was polygamous. He had 70 sons and other offspring through other sort of concubines and things like that. And his son is Abimelech, who then instigates a civil war, because he basically kills all 70 sons of Gideon, minus one, Yotham, who curses Abimelech. And so there's like 3 years of instability, Abimelech and the city of Shechem. Then God basically he sanctions suspicion and strife between the collaborators, which is Shechem and Abimelech. They destroy each other. And basically, again, a woman basically kills Abimelech. Then there is Tola. There are certain minor judges, as they say, minor in the sense that not much information is given to us. Tola from the tribe of Issachar, who lived in Ephraim, judged for 23 years. There is Yair from the tribe of Manasseh, judged for 22 years. The only information given is he had 30 sons and 30 donkeys who had 30 cities. So some of these judges, like, strange details are given. So I was thinking, why? I mean, 30 sons, 30 donkeys, 30 cities, how does it matter? But I think, again, it goes back to the audience. Who was, let's assume Samuel, who was Samuel writing to? So I think he was giving a sense of historical connection to the people who were important to Israel, to the people of Israel, to the tribal structure, and to give them context to the present, you know, to their present condition. So Israel during, let's say, 1000 BC, they probably knew these cities. And he said, like, you know, so this guy, it's his sons, and these cities are actually belonging to him. So perhaps that's that. So the Jews are very good at showing gratitude as a society. I mean, obviously we see that they are failing here, but still, among the peoples of the world, I think they are very, diligent about showing gratitude. You can look at it in terms of Holocaust, people who helped the Jews. Even after 30, 40 years, somebody finds them. You know, there was a famous case during the Balkan Wars. Somebody on a TV in Israel saw a woman, a Serbian, who helped them during the war. And the Israeli government, basically the army, they flew in a chopper, evacuated her and her family, and brought her back to Israel. She's a Gentile. She's not a Jew. So they have the sense of, you know, people who have helped us are to be at least remembered. They don't do a perfect job of it, according to God's standard, but according to all other peoples and nations, I think they are way ahead of us. And I think that's why all these minor judges who just have a name mentioned, they are mentioned because they were important to Israel. And it's important to remember them. And then we have Jephthah or Yiftah. Is a tribe from a tribe of Manasseh. He's considered a mighty warrior, a person of low birth. So his mother was a concubine of Gilead, his father, who had many siblings, and these siblings basically persecuted him, drove him out of his father's household. So he actually ran. So if we consider this, so Yiftah from here, so from this land of Gilead, so he basically ran kind of east. And he collects around him sort of useless people, as they say. But it was also a plan of God, I think, because he was fighting the Ammonites. So, you know, so he became a mighty warrior. He built up a reputation of a warrior during his kind of an exile from his kind of a birth land. So he earns a reputation. And then now, so the enemy is the Philistines and the Ammonites. So the Philistines and the Ammonites ally to kind of, in a pincer movement, trouble the Israelite people. And now you have Yiftah, who is already experienced with fighting the Ammonites. So he is given the charge, you know, God raises him. Interesting that he's, like, in the Bible's words, he is a mighty warrior. And yet he starts his duties with a call for diplomacy. So he talks to, he sends an envoy to Ammonites. He says, like, why are you doing this? The Ammonite says, your people occupied this land from us. We want it back. And it's surprising, a person of so-called low birth and possibly of, let's say, not the greatest moral compass, he had a very clear idea why Israel was justified. So the justification, like, when the Ammonites say that you people have no right, you stole this land from us, which is probably a common argument we hear even today. I think Yiftah had a very clear idea. He's like, no, I did not steal it. My God gave it to us. So it is our God who displaced you people. And if your God gives you sanctions certain land, will you not take it? So I think he had the clarity that God sanctioned this. There's actually no justification from the secular perspective for somebody to come and take somebody's land except God. God sanctified it. God sanctioned it. God basically directed it. Therefore, it is justified. That's the only reason that is necessary. And that's the reason that Yiftah gave. Yeah, you know, I like that. So, like, very clear thought process. Again, so his moral compass, again, so I think maybe because he lived away from the, or lived among the Gentiles for so long, he makes a foolish vow that if I win this battle, whoever comes, when I go home, whoever comes first, I will offer to the Lord and as a burnt offering. So now there is, I guess there's another school of thought that says he actually said, I will offer it up to the Lord or as a burnt offering. But in our Bibles, and I think most people, consensus is that he meant and. So basically he was ready to do human sacrifice. It just happened to be his daughter, his only daughter. He had no sons. So then he realizes his mistake, but instead of possibly talking to the high priest or thing, because human sacrifice is not allowed in the Jewish law, there would be a way out, according to Jewish commentary. But he didn't take that route. He went ahead with it, it says. So if the consensus is to be believed that he actually sacrificed his daughter, but obviously there is always a probability that he actually meant that she would remain a virgin, like she would remain single. Well, we don't know. And then there is Ephraim, seems to be a tribe that is pretty petty. So they come up against Yiftah and say that, why didn't you not invite us for the battle? They get pretty angry about it. They fight. There's 42,000 dead from Ephraim. That is something. And then there are three minor judges, or judges with small histories. So Ibzan, the only thing we know is he had 30 sons and 30 daughters, and he married all of them outside his tribe. Then there was Elon from the tribe of Zebulun. He judged for 10 years. Then there was Abdon from the tribe of Ephraim. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys. So again, maybe the donkeys are important. And he judged for 8 years. And then we end with Samson. I'm out of time. But we all know the story of Samson, or Shimshon, which literally means sunshine. He's from the tribe of Dan, which is kind of significant to understand, you know, what was happening there. Again, this was pre-incarnate Jesus who blesses Samson's parents. I find Samson's father, Manoah, to be an interesting character. Maybe you should read up on him also. Like, I like that he takes his wife's word at face value. The wife comes and tells, because the first two times when Jesus, or pre-incarnate Jesus, visits the wife, her name is, I think, not mentioned here, he's not there. So she conveys what happens to her. So he basically says, oh, is that so? Next time, so the first time he's not there, he says, let's ask again for them to come, for, you know, this person to come, which is, they didn't know it was Jesus. So that we can understand what to do with this son. So he's already assuming it's going to happen. It's not a case of weak faith shown by Abraham or Sarah, you know, things like that. They actually just, okay, this is going to happen to us. And then they just, the guy, I like it there, he just assumes that the word is true, he has that faith, and then he wants to know what else to do. I think he's a very task-oriented person. So God says, you know, you will raise him as a Nazarite, so no alcohol, no cutting of hair. So he wants to know what else to do, like how to raise this child. Anyway, so then Samson is, again, a good example of every one of our weaknesses. It's easy to... I always find it funny, like, you know, he had so much going on for him, like he was blessed. He judged for, I think, 20 years. It's a long time. Like, and he was clearly the strongest in that land. But his main weakness was women. And women of a particular kind, like, you know, this kind of a strident and women who behave like a dripping of constant rain, you know, in Proverbs it says. Just bad choice. So first he marries a Philistine woman. So you know that story with the lion. He poses a riddle to the bridal party who get the woman to trick him into revealing the riddle. He throws a fit, hissy fit, kills 30 people in Ashkelon, the Philistine area, and walks out. This is just, they just got married. And then after a year, so then the wife's father gives her to the best man, which is, you know, pretty salacious. He returns after a while to get her back, but the guy says, I've already given her away, so, you know, take the younger one, the sister. He gets angry again, then he captures 300 foxes, ties fire to them, sets the entire village during harvest time on fire, harvest lost, people angry. They come and they say, who's responsible for it? Somebody says, it's these people, these Philistine in-laws of Samson. They come and kill them. So now Samson gets angry at them. So then he strikes them down, and then he's hiding. So now the Philistines basically... Now, at this time, Philistines are heavy on Israel for 40 years. That is a long time. 40 years is basically two generations. And we complain about things happening. Oh, COVID, 2 years. I mean, I'm not saying that we shouldn't. I mean, complain to God, that is. But 40 years is a long time. Philistines are ruling. At this point, the people of Israel are not even allowed to have weapons. So the Philistines come, they threaten the tribe of Judah, you hand him over to us. They hand him over. He basically just rips the cord out and slaughters 1,000 people with the jawbone of a donkey. Right, so strong man. I think he also had a sense of, like, okay, in this case, it was like the Spirit of God rushed into him, so that is strength from the Spirit. But he also had a very hot temper when he threw a fit and, you know, like his wife was given away and things like that. Then he gets into prostitutes and then Delilah, the famous one. The Philistines offer her 5,500 pieces of silver. Now, if you assume 10 pieces of silver was a year's worth of salary for a Levite, imagine how much 5,500 pieces was. I'm not sure if this logic is sound of mine, but at least that's what I'm running with right now. It was a lot of money. So the five lords of the Philistines offered 1,100 pieces each, so that makes it 5,500 pieces. And we all know the sad story. And I think the harshest thing as I was reading through it was the offense to God, like how insulting it was to God when the Philistines finally captured him and they were celebrating the strength of their God. You know, I think that is the, story of Samson is sad enough, but I think it's sad when we are the cause for embarrassment for God. I think that is, for me, that really stood out. One should pray that we never be that. If anything, we should be praying that God can boast in us like he did in Job, you know, instead of being an embarrassment to him. But then he repents, and in his death, he kills 3,000. So he actually kills, in his death, he kills more Philistines than during his life. And yet, I mean, if you count it all, he probably killed at least 5,000-6,000 people by himself. And one could say, like, yeah, okay, 5,000-6,000. We tend to gloss over these numbers. But imagine this. I mean, he did this over 20 years. And, you know, the world's most most effective sniper, Simo Halliday. Like, he killed, what was it, at least 700 people? 1,000, I think, like 700 sniper shots and 1,000 in total. And that is impressive. And then he had a gun and all that stuff. Okay, it wasn't a great gun compared to, you know, his situation, but then you have Samson who killed 6,000 people without a weapon. So, and The another anecdote or story to consider is that Samson, like all the stories that you see Samson like this big cartoon character with a V body and muscles and shoulders and, you know, traps and or whatnots. But in all likelihood, Samson was as a normal bodied person like us. Maybe not fat like me, but, you know, normal body, like slim, things like that. Because God doesn't work through impressive looking people. I think that's my understanding as well, that his strength lay in the fact that he lived as a Nazirite, committed to God. I mean, one could be tempted to say it was in his hair, but the hair was just a sign of his commitment to stay in that covenant. And so I don't think he was an impressive man in that sense, not like Goliath or somebody. So the period of the personalities ends there. It ends with Samson, the sad story of Samson that we all should relate to. And I kind of sympathize with him, a troubled man definitely who had his weaknesses. A lot was put on him. After 40 years, he was the one who was kind of easing it for the people of Israel. And I think a lot of people around him took advantage of him. And I think calls for sympathy for him. And so the final study type is the purpose. Two very short points. So the book of Judges apparently is in the Hebrew Bible along with the book of Ruth. They are one book. So apart from the immediate purpose, why Samuel wrote it for the audience of the united Israel under the Saul monarchy. So the purpose, the sort of like what is God trying to show or what can we read into it? I think it's also like if you combine this with Ruth, I think Ruth is a very, if it is one book, it's interesting that Ruth, the Judges doesn't end with Samson, but it ends with Ruth. So you can see that it's another perspective of God's plan for our salvation. You know, we all go through the cycle of corruption, backsliding, then we get the trouble or persecution, then we cry out our penance or like remorse, and then there's that salvation that God offers. And this is possible because God is loyal to his covenant, and I think his loyalty is shown with this book that ends with the story of Ruth. Ruth, who is a Gentile woman, all these judges are actually, well, except Shamgar, like they are members of Israel. But it ends with Ruth, who is pivotal to the royal line, and Jesus being our ultimate salvation, the once and final salvation. So in the Judges book, Israel had to go through these cycles of seven cycles of, you know, this sinning, repenting, salvation. Sinning, repenting, salvation. You know, so these three cycles. So I think if you look at the entire book, one could look at it as it ends with the precursor, like, you know, the elements of the final plan, which is how God comes into our world as the final solution for our salvation. And Ruth is a nice contrast to Judges. You know, if you look at the three main characters in Ruth, Naomi, her mother-in-law, and Boaz, her future husband. So it's like Ruth, who is a receptive and obedient Gentile. Like she's very tender-hearted. And she's influenced by this older Israelite woman who is loving and very pragmatic, I think. And most of all, Boaz, who is a very discerning Israelite man. You have Samson, who is the opposite of that. He couldn't discern the right woman or, you know, who to be staying away from. And then you have Boaz that ends this combined book, who is the opposite of Samson. He recognizes, even in a Gentile woman, Samson did the same thing. He married Philistine women. Ruth was a Moabitess. But he understood from the God's perspective what was right, how God works in people, and he married her. And credit to him, he's in the line of Jesus now. So that's his reward. So all these three people come together to play a part in the arrival of the ultimate salvation for all future cycles of all people, of all God's people, like ours, people before us, people after us. And application, okay, I went way long, so I'm going to have to unfortunately cut down on this one. I have two main applications here, which again is my burden, is that number one, introspection. How we look at testing periods in our lives, it affects what steps we take. We will fail. We are human. Doesn't mean, you know, we should try not to fail. It just means it is very much a possibility, a probability. So we will fail. But testing is not something that is, you know, like a condemnation from God. It can be a testing, as long as we are sincere and we introspect. So he understands our nature. He keeps us testing. He keeps us in this testing periods to keep the fire in us going. He loves us, therefore he disciplines us. And it's important to acknowledge one's own role in our oppressive periods. So whenever in this book, the Jews, they cried out to God because they were oppressed, at least in a couple of times, they repent. They sin. You know, we sinned against you, God. Take this away from us. So I think when we go through these periods, I think the primary thing and the most important thing to do is to acknowledge, to recognize and acknowledge our role in our situation. And one needn't be fatalistic, as Hindus would be, you know, well, I deserve it, so be it. You know, our God is an eager God. He is an eager Savior, as long as he sees genuine repentance. And that is our responsibility, to show him genuine repentance. He understands we are weak. In this book, we see weak men in Gideon, Samson, Barak, and even Elijah or Eliyahu, who does marvelous miracles. And yet, when Jezebel threatens him, he fears. He fears for his life and runs. So weakness is a human condition. We should exercise God's grace to then overcome it whenever we encounter it. And the oral tradition. So this is something like close to my heart. Again, I was saying that Jews have a strong sense of oral tradition. They pass on the information. But again, in this book, time and again, you can see in verses chapter 2:10, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work he had done for Israel. And that's a recurring theme. And Miska, a few Sundays back, he mentioned, you know, remembering. And I think this is a very important part of remembering. Books, yes, obviously, because that's least corrupt way of passing on information. But I think you only really get context through oral tradition. When you hear from your previous generations, parents, grandparents, you know, whatever, previous generations, like older people teach to the younger people. It gives you the context of what was it like. And the sad thing is these days, the way families are growing up, we don't even know our own parents' context. How did they grow up? Like my parents grew up in a very socialist time of India, where you had to wait for maybe like 3 years to get a car because there was a queue, you know, things like that. There could be something like in China, like how was it during your parents' time of Cultural Revolution, perhaps? And not just as a statement of facts, but to understand how people went through those times. You know, who were the ones who helped you? And I'm not saying at a national scale, but even at the family scale, who is important to our family? You know, who have been friends of the family? Are we loyal to them as the Jews are now? Things like that. So if we don't even show gratitude in these small things, in our small lives, in our small context, how are we going to understand the immenseness that the Bible is? Like the Bible, every book is an example of how we should be grateful to God for setting up a plan for our salvation. And yeah, so, and the danger is, like, we tend to overestimate our sense of history, our collective memories. We think that, oh, you know, this is always a tradition. But really, we only remember our own history, maybe parents, maybe grandparents at the most. That's only less than 50, 60 years. So it is important to have a sense of continuity in good and bad stories. What was wrong? What did we do wrong in our lifetimes or in our previous life, or, like, you know, previous generations' lifetimes? Things like that. And it's very important to be skeptical of one's own understanding of history and context, because there are certain things we don't understand. Just as these days, you know, it's dismissed as a generation gap. I think it's complete nonsense. It is something that should be actively fought against. If there is a generation gap, and there will be some difference in generations, but if there is a gap to the point that you accept it, I think it's a dangerous sign where you do not relate to your previous generation. God speaks through to us, not just through the scriptures, obviously almost majorly through the scriptures, but also through the people in our lives, through the good people in our lives, you know, the goodness that comes from God, through the bad people in our lives, where we, which exhibits our own fallenness, but, you know, in other people also. So I would say, I just want to end with saying that it's our responsibility. I mean, God is gracious. He is merciful. He will always save us. Like, he is, his hand, saving hand, is ever close to us. But it is our responsibility to continually introspect, to look within us, and to exercise his grace to tenderize our hearts and to sharpen our conscience so that we can root out any sin that may be in us, and to remember all the good works that he did in our lives. Sorry it took half an hour more than except it was supposed to. So I would like to pray, end this with a prayer from Psalm 141. I think it's just kind of appropriate for this book and for my emphasis. So this is a psalm of David. O Lord, I call upon you. Hasten to me. Give ear to my voice when I call to you. Let my prayer be counted as incense before you, and the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. Set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips. Do not let my heart incline to any evil, to busy myself with wicked deeds, in company with men who work iniquity, and let me not eat of the delicacies. Let a righteous man strike me, it is a kindness. Let him rebuke me, it is oil for my head. Let my head not refuse it. Yet my prayer is continually against the evil deeds. When their judges are thrown over the cliff, then they shall hear my words, for they are pleasant. As when one plows and breaks up the earth, so shall our bones be scattered at the mouth of Sheol. But my eyes are toward you, O God, my Lord. In you I seek refuge. Leave me not defenseless. Keep me from the trap that they have laid for me, and from the snares of evildoers. Let the wicked fall into their own nets while I pass by safely. Amen.